episode 4 is over, but we are just getting started here at Post Show Recaps. I am LaTanya Starks, and I am here with the effervescent, the beautiful, the talented, the gorgeous, the smart, Sarah Carradine. Sarah, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm speechless. I thought there was a third person on the podcast that you were going to introduce. I have a handful of peppermints for you, LaTanya.
Oh,
would you like one?
I did put my head all the way under the water, so I
did
think
you?
I deserve one.
Peppermint
candy is
well.
So 80s. Like, I would, if someone gave me a peppermint as a reward, I'd be like, who are you?
She likes our peppermints.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Very much
yes.
So.
Yes.
So we are recapping Love and Death with full spoilers, people. Full spoilers for Love and Death. Watch the series on HBO in the US and binge it in Australia, which I have to tell you, I'm very jealous about. Subscribe to the feed so you don't miss a minute of our coverage. PostShowRecaps.com/HBO. That's PostShowRecaps.com/HBO. And if you have a moment, please take some time and rate and review us. It makes a huge difference. Give us those 5-star ratings that we deserve.
5 stars only.
5 stars only. I literally don't think the algorithm allows me to see any rating below 5 stars. So
I think it just deletes it. I mean, it axes everything under 5 stars.
It does.
Also, like, why
it
are you
does.
Giving something 4 stars? Like, if it's 4 stars, give it 5 stars.
Give it 5. Like, what are you doing? This isn't an Uber. This is a podcast.
Yeah, and also give your Uber drivers 5 stars unless they're actively evil.
Yeah.
They're doing a hard job.
They need
just
it.
Give them 5. They
just
need
give
it.
Them 5
you
stars.
Don't. Yeah, just give them 5.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's not like you've got a budget of stars. You've got as many stars
yeah.
as you want.
That's very true. That's very true. There's no star ration cards going on.
Correct.
So yeah, please rate and review us. Makes a huge difference and we appreciate it greatly. So we are here today to recap episode 4, which is entitled Do No Evil. And spoiler alert, some evil gets done.
Some small evil.
Some tiny evil. You ready to talk about this one, Sarah?
I think so. Yes, I liked this episode very much. I have to say the uptick in the pace of it.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 4, after the slightly languorous first 3 episodes, which we spoke about last time we talked. I mean, we wasn't a huge criticism, but we had a little, like, let's get to the fireworks factory. We got to the fireworks factory
yeah.
in the first minute.
Yeah, we definitely got there. Candy kills Betty.
Yeah, she sure does.
My goodness. I like a lot of people who decided that they were going to tune in for a show called Love and Death probably knew there was going to be a little bit of loving and a little bit of death. But I really was a little surprised in the 8-episode run that halfway through, we are already past the killing. Like, we start the episode with the killing of Betty.
Yeah, we start immediately after. It's a complete run-on from the end of episode 3 where we saw Betty bring in the axe. And this is just the next moment. Here we are.
Mm-hmm.
LaTanya, we are trying not to do too much comparison with the miniseries
yes.
Candy from last year, and certainly not too much comparison with the facts of the case that you and I, as true crime lovers or aficionados, know very well. Mm-hmm. But I would say, interestingly, this program, certainly in this episode, seems to take the Candy version of events
yes.
as gospel, if I may
yes.
use that phrase. Whereas Candy left it for us as to whether we believed Candy or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. So what we're talking about in terms of version of events is what played out at trial, which I know we'll definitely cover in future episodes of this podcast, but the only account that we have of what happened, other than maybe a police reconstruction, is an account that comes from Candy herself that is both a combination of initially what she told police happened and what was like presented at our trial. But also I know there were like several passes of hypnosis that were done, wherein, you know, Candy tells this story completely, but the details are a little bit different when she's telling it under hypnosis than when she is telling it, you know, in court. What do you think here of, like, speaking of the year ago TV show Candy, and the fact that we get a very grueling choreographed fight scene that happens between Candy and Betty in Candy, and in this show it's a lot more artistic, I guess, in terms of how it's presented, in that we get the beginnings of a struggle but mostly the aftermath, and then police style photos. What do you think about the difference in the way these two shows presented the murder, and which did you prefer?
I'm liking Love and Death, but I was passionate about Candy. Mm. So poor old Love and Death does come in as the second place of two. So, you know, silver medal. Well done. There are things that I'm liking about Love and Death as it unfolds more than Candy. And I certainly think the longer runtime is mm-hmm. going to go into some very interesting nooks and crannies, like the hypnosis, because some people can't be hypnotized. Was she actually hypnotized? I'm really looking forward to seeing Elizabeth Olsen do that. I think we're going to get more of the court than we got in Candy, and I'm looking forward to that. I have to say, Candy, episode 1 of 5, the murder has happened.
Right.
But we don't see it. We see Candy arrive in one state. We see her leave the house in another state. And then throughout the first episode, the camera just returns to the outside of the house and just looks at the house. And this rising dread that it's a very domestic shot. It's a fixed camera shot of a house.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a dread there because we know something happened.
Right.
We don't get the as you say, choreographed murder of Betty by Candy until much later. And we're right in the middle of it. We don't get the build-up to it. And what's interesting here, and this is Candy's telling, and the court agreed that it was self-defense, we get the self-defense that
right.
Betty came for Candy with the axe, and Candy was defending herself by, not to put too fine a point on it, absolutely slaughtering Betty.
Yeah. It was like, 42?
Yes, like Lizzie Borden, one more than Lizzie Borden. It was mm-hmm. 42. She does have a wound on her foot. This is correct because we know this from real and from both the shows. But there is an argument to be made that she cut her own foot with a swing of the axe. Here we see very clearly shown that Betty swings the axe, misses her, but catches her on the foot.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I wonder if later we're going to get a different, I mean, this would be a very intriguing way around it, mm-hmm. that we see the murder again, but we see it in a different style, perhaps when the police are reconstructing it. What did you think comparatively of the two?
There was something just so striking about that scene in Candy between Jessica Biel and Melanie Lynskey, where you really did feel as if you were a part of the struggle for the axe that these two women were fighting over. It was visceral, and I think that as a result, it kind of one-ups what we get here in Love and Death. Just, you know, that the choreography alone, like, that looks so tiring, and it looked like, you know, you have to be in such great shape to carry that out. It looked exhausting.
Yeah, and I mean, they were grunting, they were panting, you kind of really got it, and you couldn't bear it, and you wanted it to be over, and it went on, and you thought, please stop going on. But it takes time to axe someone 42 times.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they showed all of it in its, like, gory glory, I guess we could say. And then, you know, but both shows are very clear on what happens next, which is that Candy goes into the shower of this woman's house that she just has killed, and she takes a shower. And later we see that she goes home and washes her clothes, dries them, changes, puts those clothes back on, but changes shoes.
Yes, very importantly.
Yeah, very importantly. Interesting detail that I don't know if we got in the Candy series of the little girl across the street who was a potential witness. Do you remember whether or not we got that? I don't think we did.
We didn't, and it was very strange because the girl looked like an automaton doll. not a lot of relaxation. And we don't know why she goes and rings a doorbell. A child that age wouldn't go, that's strange. A wet woman got into a car. I think it's to play with the dogs. That's what I thought.
Oh, yeah. The dogs or the little... There is like another little girl that typically lives there.
That, yes. I mean, what we do get, though, is as she rings the doorbell, we can hear the phone ringing and the baby crying inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, going a completely different way from the silent house. We now get this almost cacophony of noise. And you do think there's a baby.
Yeah, for sure. The fact that Candy takes the time to go in and shower and still like continues to miss spots, or like, you know, there are places where she's bleeding. And then she has the presence of mind to wash and dry her clothes so she can put them back on, because she has to go back to Vacation Bible Camp and pick up her kids. She tells this very interesting story about how, and she tells it exactly the same way each time she tells it, where she says, well, we just got to talking, and we played with the puppies, and then I went to Target in Plano, but I realized that my watch stopped, and I just got back here as fast as I could, and I completely missed the puppet show. So that was my attempt at being Elizabeth Olsen.
It was wonderful.
Thank you.
This is a device that Candy used as well, this very precise, and this is one of the things they say you can tell a liar, because the details don't change. She tells people at the Bible camp, she tells her husband on the phone she's going to ring him shortly and tell him to bring enough money for the cinema, and completely unnecessarily tells that story as well.
The look on his face, he's like, okay, good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Pat really just an unsung hero in this show, because
he is so good. Like, really so good. I loved our old Pat, but Patrick Fugit is, oh, he's perfection.
Yes.
He's not given a lot to do, but he's in every scene he's in, right? You know, he's there. It's wonderful.
Definitely. And Pat is kind of such a nothing burger of a man.
Mm-hmm.
That it's interesting to see Patrick Fugit kind of like bring a person like that to life. What do you think of Elizabeth Olsen's performance as she's kind of trying to like settle herself down and go through this day as, you know, as nonplussed as possible?
Well, it's a different choice from what we saw in Candy. What we saw in Candy was a complete dissociation until she gets to Bible camp, to Vacation Bible Camp. Here we see Elizabeth Olsen actively settling herself, talking herself through it, concerned, figuring it out very actively. Whereas in Candy, we saw just almost an automaton stepping through the actions that she has to take,
mm-hmm.
which then bolsters her story of the fact that she kind of blanked out.
Yeah.
Well, how did you find it? A bit too active, or did you find it was just right?
No, I thought that it was good, because it was kind of like the way that she says to herself, nothing is different. Like she's very,
yes, I liked that. Yes. Yeah,
I like that little beat because she's very much trying to tell herself that everything is okay. Like if fake it until you make it kind of thing. And there's something that is so, it's a combination of you feel bad if things actually did play out the way that Candy says that they did and she was defending herself. You kind of feel bad for her, but at the same time, you're like, how cold-blooded is this woman? She killed this other woman whose husband she had been having an affair with. She left a one-year-old child just there to, you know, have whatever happens as she cries for nothing because her mother is gone. And she has the other child with her and, like, keeps her fully knowing that she has murdered her mother. Like I think that the cognitive dissonance that the character kind of creates for you is really interesting. And I think that Elizabeth Olsen is doing a pretty good job of playing it here.
Yes. I mean, when she finds out that Alan has gone away, she has a tiny moment because she didn't know Alan was going away because they're no longer having an affair. Therefore, they're no longer doing diaries and left. And we know, and look, she is a wonderful actress and I'm loving watching her performance. She knows that that baby is alone in the house.
Yeah.
And has been since 10 o'clock in the morning and with Alan nowhere in sight.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to think, if she lets herself think, it's like, how will this be discovered? How will this be discovered?
Mm-hmm. So she's going through all these motions as Sherry comes over to grab the card table. She can't even remember at this point, like, what Sherry is doing there. She just immediately hears the knock at the door and kind of goes into fight or flight mode. And Sherry immediately picks up on that there's something wrong and we get that same story again. Mm-hmm. What do you think of this beat?
I like it because, you know, Sherry's serving the blue, the powder blue garage doors on the eyes, the hair, the lip. In the 80s, it wasn't choose your eyes or your lips. It was choose everything.
Yes, it was everything.
On.
Yeah.
But it's what I liked about that is the domesticity of these women and the things they have to do. They have a series of things that they have to do all day.
Mm-hmm.
Housewives are not sitting around eating chocolates with their feet up. Well, some of them might be, and good luck to them. But this idea of the roster of things that must be done, and Sherry has relatives coming, and she... We imagine for her list of things to do today. And one of them is pick up the card table from Candy, and that they're good enough friends that you just pop in, get the card table and leave. You don't have to make a small talk. So she notices in some part of her brain, she notices that there's something, but she's also fully ready to accept. Oh yes. I mean, Candy says, oh, where's my brain today? And it's like, oh yes, yes, you've got so much on.
Yeah.
And her pull is to her own home where various things are going on there. She needs the card table. She needs to do that. So I really liked in this very small moment, and it's just these two great actors performing it as well, and that with the number of episodes that we're going to get, we have time for these kind of moments.
Yeah, I completely agree. So Alan is busy going to the airport, and he's calling Betty. So we learn that, you know, the phone's been ringing kind of nonstop and it's Alan calling Betty, but getting absolutely no reply. We see this, kind of, idyllic scene at the swimming pool where everyone is there. The woman who's sitting close to Candy with that fat, fat baby. Oh my gosh.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
That made me so happy. I love a fat baby.
Yes. And a naked fat baby right beside Candy. And she's studiously not looking at them. She's in her own world, as you would imagine.
Completely. And then the same thing happens when they are at the Empire Strikes Back. And truly, how can you be watching a movie like The Empire Strikes Back and just sleepwalking through the entirety of it. What are you doing?
She just killed someone.
No, I'm just kidding.
It made me so.
The Star Wars side of me, though, still feels that I would be caught up in the character drama, even after a murder.
Surely. Yes. Oh, well, let's test it.
No. Okay. So Alan is calling again, this time from the Ramada Inn.
I love
the days of a good Ramada Inn.
I was so happy to see him at the check-in counter of the Ramada Inn. I mean, his phone calls are so nicely placed in the office before he leaves, at the airport before he gets on the plane, at the airport when he gets off the plane. Here, he hasn't even got to his room and he's ringing her. And while we lamented somewhat the repetition of the first three episodes, I loved this here.
Yeah.
Because we are with him. So Candy, no emotion, closed down. Alan, a rising dread as he rings. And he knows his wife doesn't go anywhere.
Exactly.
He knows his wife doesn't go anywhere. And one time she might have been in the bathroom. One time she might have been in the backyard. But so many times for her not to answer the phone. I think it's really nicely placed. But, yes, this recreation of the 1980 Ramada Inn reception area, fully brown and beige.
Yes.
He's brown and beige and everything's brown and beige.
Brown and beige. Wonderful. Those are the colors of the 80s for professional people anyway. I agree with you. I think that Jesse Plemons is doing a really great job just kind of playing the rising dread that is creeping over this man as he realizes that his wife is just not answering the phone. When she doesn't go anywhere, and he knows that that she has the baby there as well, so this all prompts Alan to he is at a dinner. He decides to leave that and to go and try to call again, and then he calls his neighbor Richard and asks Richard to check to see if Betty is home. So Richard goes over and he knocks and he rings. And he tells Alan that she must be out. Plot continuing to thicken. Alan really is helpless because he's out of town. So the only thing he can continue to do is make these phone calls. So he calls Candy and asks, has she seen Betty? She's not answering the phone. Candy kind of tells the same canned story about she just went over there to get Alyssa's swimsuit and that was the last time she saw her, but she would be happy to go over there if he wants and check. So that's all weird. What do you think of her volunteering herself to go over there and discover the murder she committed?
Bold. It's very bold. Because if, let's say she didn't kill Betty, I mean, they're in bed in their pajamas. Everybody knows bedtime. And also you don't ring in the old days. Kids ask your grandparents. You didn't ring anybody after 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
It was like, so if the phone rang after 9 o'clock, it was definitely an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
So one would think, given the milieu that we've been beautifully presented and these people are inhabiting, I would have thought that she would have said, do you want me to send Pat over to look? That would be much more. What would happen? Alan's too distressed to kind of, but also they know they've had an affair, so it kind of elides the fact that she would go and look. But but it's really the men folk. It's the, you get the real men folk idea from this whole sequence of events. I would have thought she'd send Pat over, but imagine Candy now knowing that Alan's on the scent, wondering how to get somebody over there to find Betty because of the baby. And this is maybe why she offers.
Yeah. So this is at the point where they're in the middle of dinner. And Alan again calls Richard to check and asks him to check the garage because he wants to know whether or not Betty's car is there.
Well, this is why Richard thought in all versions, in Candy, in this, and in reality, Richard thought she was out because he couldn't see her car. But the car was unusually in the garage.
Yeah, and the garage door was open.
Yes.
And apparently Betty never leaves the garage door open, and especially wouldn't do that while he was away, while Alan was away. So a bunch of other neighborhood men start to just kind of like emerge from their homes with flashlights because yes. Alan has called all of them to get like a little squad together to go. We will talk about what they find right after this. Okay, and now we are back. So the men figure out a way to enter the house, and it's pretty easy because the front door is open, and they find the baby, and then they find Betty dead, and the man who finds her in that state is immediately like, don't go in there, which of course prompts another man to go right yes. in there.
Yes. How do you get a man to go in there? You say, don't go in there.
Exactly. You can tell, I think that these like three actors who aren't really in the rest of the show very much, they do a really good job here kind of, you know, emoting the sense of dread that you would have if you were, you know, looking in a house that seems so eerily quiet. Don't you think?
Yes. Not a light on. A baby by itself is a very unusual sight. I love the man that just embraced the little baby and took it away. I thought, thank God, some, you know, someone was there, ran it over the road to give it to his wife is what he did.
Of course.
The tenderness and care. And I think there's a wonderful idea almost of little boys pretending to be brave in front of each other. I agree with you. I thought they did a really nice job with this.
So Alan calls again, and this time his neighbor answers the phone.
Yes. Can you imagine?
No. And the first neighbor can't even do it. He has to hand the phone over to Richard, I think.
Yes.
And Richard is the one who tells him the bad news. You know, the baby's okay, he says. But
he starts with the baby's okay. Alan's got to know there's something wrong.
He has to know there's something wrong.
He knew. It's that awful thing where you think something might be wrong, and then you try and persuade yourself that you're being foolish, and then when you find out that nothing was wrong, you feel really foolish. But here he knows, and as soon as Richard said the baby's fine, he's got to know what's going on.
He has to. And initially they say that Betty's been shot.
Yes.
Because they have no idea. This is consistent across Candy and Love and Death, right? The idea that everyone thinks that Betty has been shot at first.
Because there's just so much blood. They can't they can't imagine that it's anything else, really.
Exactly. So we get Candy and Pat are having a marriage encounter.
They sure are.
And it is interrupted, of course, by Alan, who calls Candy and tells Candy the news that Candy already knows because she's the one who did it.
I wonder how she feels when she hears that Betty's been shot.
Exactly. Yeah. And she just bursts into tears here.
Mm. Mm.
We interestingly don't get her telling Pat, which I thought was a choice.
I was waiting for that. I love this bursting into tears because we know it's a relief. She can react now. She can be weird and sad now. She can cry. Mm-hmm. She can shake, all the things she hasn't been able to do all day.
Yeah, it's more of a release for her at this point.
I think so,
than
yes.
anything else.
Yes.
So the police kind of converge on Betty's house.
Oh, but this was a bit of very black humor. There are policemen smoking. There are policemen helping themselves to the peppermint candy.
Yeah.
There are policemen sitting and walking all around everywhere. I mean, and the place is packed with unnecessary policemen. I think they're so excited. We find out from the news it's the first murder for 25 years
right.
in this town. And I think they're all so excited. I mean, there's 6-8 police cruisers outside.
I know.
And you just think, ah, preserve the crime scene.
I know. One of them does mention that later, but like it's also not just police that are in there. Like the three men that found her are just still there, just sitting there smoking cigarettes, like drinking coffee, just, you know. And of course the police decide it's one of them cult deals.
Yes, yes.
Because everything is a cult in the 80s. That's just something that is very important to know, like how wild it was, the reporting around cults in the 80s.
Or a drifter that's come through town and left. Oh,
the drifter, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That you'll never find them because
you'll never find them, they're a drifter.
It's not your neighbor, it's not your husband, it's not your wife.
Right. Alan calls back to his house to speak to the police. They think that Betty was shot and they tell him that. And Alan is surprised, like, you know, we don't even own a gun, he says. And he just kind of has this, like, little moment of a breakdown because he's just in Minnesota, like, in the Twin Cities, in a hotel room, like, having the worst day of his life.
And how is he going to tell his older child? How is he going to bring up two children? I mean, I'm sure he's not thinking clearly, but all of this is... Right. The helplessness of him and not being there for him. I like the early morning candy getting ready for breakfast. And I wrote you a note, which was, has Elizabeth Olsen never used a juice extractor before? I think somebody should have helped her. So that's not how you use it. I'm talking about the old-fashioned squeezes that you did by hand. Elizabeth Olsen has never met one of these before.
She's doing it wrong.
She's doing it so wrong.
Oh, because I know there are the ones that you can actually squeeze, like, you know, it has two handles and you can like squeeze them together.
They're great. That,
yeah. Yeah,
they're fantastic. Get those and you turn it inside out. This is the one that's shaped almost like a hat and you squeeze around and around and around. And she's got her hand flat and she's wiggling it backwards. It took me out slightly. Those who didn't notice won't notice, but I do. I mean, it's like in the film, the girl with the pearl earring. Uh-huh. They gave the cook a you know, the curved knife with the two handles, but they didn't tell her how to use it. You rock that backwards and forwards over herbs so you don't bruise them, and she's there banging it up and down on the board. Can somebody please show this actress how to use this implement?
I think it works for me just because I was thinking the whole time, like, wow, she really is taking out all the frustration that she has right now in this moment that on those oranges.
She certainly, the performance of it is certainly very apt. It's a dusky morning. We feel it's first thing in the morning. Mm-hmm. She's up. She's busy. Like, she's really frantically busy, not a sort of droopy morning like I have where it takes me a while of drifting around to even sort of open my eyes.
Oh, yeah. And who are these people who get fresh squeezed orange juice every morning for breakfast? Like, what?
Suburban
Wiley, Texas?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Okay. That makes sense to me. Yes. So the police have surveyed the scene and they've come to the conclusion that the bloody footprints are too small to be a man's, so it must either be a woman or a child.
Yeah, because men don't have small feet.
No.
Latana, did you not know that? That's forensic.
Well, I would...
Please be scientific with it.
I would immediately be mistaken for a man because I have huge feet.
Same.
Same. It's good to know that we're still using... of course, it's not outdated. It's just about time for it when this is set. Alan returns home after what I can only imagine was a hellish flight. It's hard enough to travel, but, you know, to know that you're coming home to this must be awful.
I mean, airline passengers were perhaps slightly better behaved in 1980. We used to dress to get on an airplane.
That's true.
Just a little note.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there was also still smoking allowed.
Yes. And there was the smoking section and the non-smoking section. I'm not sure how the smoke knew not to move from one section to the other, but there we go.
It's sophisticated like that. Mm-hmm. It knows where it belongs. So he gets the news that Betty wasn't shot. In fact, it was an axe. And the neighbors have gone ahead and cleaned up the house.
I mean, again, all our true crime aficionados will be like,
I know.
I mean, the neighbors were doing it as a kindness.
Right.
But they've gone in and they've cleaned the house. So whatever evidence didn't get collected in the middle of the night, gone.
Completely gone. Yeah, because everyone knows that when you're working in forensics, the immediate first pass through the house is the only thing that you need ever from a very crowded crime scene.
Yes. So, and especially as the photographs were being taken on film. So how do you know that you don't need more photographs? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I know it's a fiction, but I think the filmmakers want us to feel that. They want us to feel this worry. They want us to feel how the helplessness of Alan. Even the fact that the neighbors cleaned, which was a kindness, is also somehow, what is he to do? What do you do when you come home to the house that has nobody in it? That was a crime scene. What are you going to do? Sit on the sofa?
Yeah.
Terrible.
I think that Jesse Plemons does a really good job in this scene because he's saying that Betty was always afraid that something would happen to her or her and the kids while Alan was away, while he was away. And it's the man's job to take care of, you know, his family, and he's gone out of town. And exactly what she feared has happened. So that was just a good little, I think, moment.
He is so good all throughout. Yeah. All throughout this episode, from the first time we see him is the first, and most of the episode he's acting by himself. From the first call, when he called from the office when he was about to leave for the airport, he really has strung, really marked through this rising dread, hearing the news as he sits on a saggy Ramada in bed. And we have a moment where he hangs up the phone and he's just there. He's completely in the wrong place, lost everything, and just sitting. And to this homecoming, I he's so good. I can't say enough good things about him.
Really good, like a way more grounding performance than I think what we got in Candy.
I agree.
In terms of the husband.
I agree. Yes.
So Candy, here she is entering the picture. She brings Alyssa home along with Pat. And Alan asks Pat and Candy to stay while he tells his daughter that her mother is dead. And, you know, we get this kind of very touching scene of Alan having to, like, kind of get down on one knee so he's at his daughter's level, explain to her exactly what's going on. And then we get, after this, you know, when the father and daughter hug, here comes Candy.
Here comes Candy.
To put her arms around both of them and cry along with them. And this is just diabolical to me.
It was stunning. So well written, so well shot, so well acted. The young girl is very good. I suppose she's about 9 or so. Just listening with her big eyes. It was absolutely a jewel of a moment. Well, I think one thing that Love and Death does, and again, this might be to do with its longer episodic run, is we do get these moments. We're allowed to sit with these moments more. You know, it's a different way of storytelling. And I just certainly appreciated it here.
Yeah.
And he tells her in such a clumsy way. It's like, no, don't tell. Just say mommy's gone. Like, not, you don't have to, you know. Not that a bad person came in. Does he say bad man or bad person? I can't remember, but someone bad came in and hurt her.
Yeah.
And that idea that you're planting in a child's head that someone bad can just come into your house. Well, they can. But it's wonderful because the bad person is standing right there and is about to embrace you and let her tears fall upon your hair. I mean, it was stunning.
Yeah. And this is just, honestly, this is one of several episodes that we get, or not episodes, but several instances, I should say, that we get of Candy just having the unmitigated gall to do any of the things that she's saying and doing. Like, I yes. can't believe this woman. What do you,
including
what do you
accepting
think?
Other people's sympathy that her friend just did.
I know.
What else is she to do, though? I like that Elizabeth Olsen is not showing us any internal turmoil. I like that she is showing us what Candy would have shown the world, mm-hmm. the facade of the friend who's, you know, with the murdered woman, the mother, the protector of the young girl. I like that we're not being shown her internal turmoil, if indeed she has any, LaTanya, really.
I don't know that she does have any, honestly. I mean, we're certainly not seeing any. And that's something I wanted to ask you about when it comes to Elizabeth Olsen's characterization of Candy as a person so far in this series. Are you seeing any interiority here, just in terms of, I mean, this woman has done some pretty judgeable things. The affair with her quote-unquote best friend's husband, the premeditated nature of the way the affair was carried out was in and of itself just like a wild thing to witness. And then to see her so kind of like deftly put aside any feelings that she might have about actually taking this woman's life and embrace her daughter and husband in this moment. Like, what do you think like of the inner life of this character as brought forth by Elizabeth Olsen?
I think that's a really good question. The Candy of Candy mm-hmm. was almost a tabula rasa. She was unreadable, and I really liked that performance yeah. from an actress who doesn't have she's fine, she doesn't have a huge range right. but it worked really well in Candy, like really well, because we saw nothing and I loved that. I love the boldness of that, and this, it was called Candy, she is the center of the show. And we're getting nothing. I thought it was a masterstroke. I really did, a great piece of casting, a great performance, and it worked really well for me. Elizabeth Olsen is a wonderful actor. I'm getting some glimpses, but not enough or too much. I am comparing the two performances, but taking this performance alone, it feels a little squishy. It feels a little spongy. And I feel like it's the performance and not the character Candy. What do you think?
Yeah, that's the reason I asked the question, because I'm, you know, with us being such true crime aficionados, you kind of wonder what happens inside of a person when they commit a crime such as this and continue to carry on with life as if life has put upon them in some way, shape or form, when they were the ones that committed the murder, like what type of person it would take, like, you know, in order to do that and to like carry that out in the world. And I'm trying to figure out if it's the way that the character is written or the way the character is being acted, that it doesn't seem like there's much motivation behind the eyes of the performance, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and I think this is why one of the masterstrokes of Candy is that we didn't see the murder until many episodes later. The murder occurs in episode one, but we don't see it. And so we are looking at Candy and trying to ascribe emotions. We're trying to ascribe motive. We're trying to ascribe things to her. It's like a fascinating puzzle.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to watch Elizabeth Olsen. I think she has moments like when she cries when the news comes on the phone, but then they missed the opportunity of her telling Pat and Pat comforting. I mean, like I'm not out, but I'm not all the way in, if you know what I mean.
I completely understand what you mean. And that's why I asked the question. I'm just trying to figure out if there's any there with this series.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm having a little bit, like, I'm enjoying myself. Like, don't get me wrong. I'm definitely enjoying, you know, the performances. I'm enjoying the soundtrack. I mean, we got like all kinds of songs. Like, we got Blondie in this episode. I'm enjoying like all of the typical things that a David E. Kelly show means to me, but it just seems like there's not enough there.
Yes. We will discuss, I'm sure, towards the end of the run, better on a binge ?
Yes. The inevitable question.
It is the inevitable question. I like week by week drops. I mean, Yellow Jackets, I have one. I have one ready. I look forward to it. We had a 2-week break. How dare they?
I know.
But week by week drops can be fantastic. We'll discuss as we get later whether this should have been dropping in pairs or dropping in threes. Look, when I say I'm not all the way in, I'm all the way in on watching it and talking to you about it every week. I'm fascinated. I'm really excited to see what they do.
Yeah.
But I'm not all the way in on the central, whether it's the writing of the central character, the directing of the central character, or the performance of the central character. Yeah. It's as if some element isn't quite calibrated. But we shall see, because we might be taken by. So there might be a flowering of this and a reason why it's like this.
Exactly. So there's gossip afoot. There's gossip in the churchyard, which is,
oh my God, brilliant.
Anyone who knows, who's ever gone to church, this would be the only thing that everyone is talking about in a small town at church on Sunday. Candy pulls Don aside, which looks sketchy. Because as he's like standing there having a discussion about how the first 48 hours are so critical in solving a case like this, and Candy pulls Don aside because he's an attorney and essentially asks, should she be worried because the police have asked to see her? And she keeps saying she was the last one to see Betty alive.
Which is true.
Yeah.
Whereas Don was established in the first three episodes. We didn't mention him, but he's a member of the upstanding member of the church community, and certainly enjoyed Pat's singing voice.
Played by Tom Pelfrey, who you would know from Ozark.
Yes. Yes. I'm glad he was very nicely integrated early on, so that now it's very natural that she would speak to him. And does he not say, well, you weren't really the last person to see her alive. And we and Candy are going, yes, she was.
I said what I said.
Yeah, I said what I said. Exactly. Yeah.
So there's a wake at the Gore house where Candy meets Bertha. Bertha is Betty's mother. And they meet in the room where it happened. So to
it's
Hamilton.
So good. So good. Because there's a bash on the refrigerator door. So this is a little utility room with the washer and dryer in it and the extra fridge freezer and all of that. Mm-hmm. So there's a bash. So she's looking at this cleaned room, but she's seeing the scars of the event. And here comes Bertha. Oh, so good.
I know. And those dogs saw. They know what's happening.
Yeah.
If we had some Black Mirror machines, then this would have been solved immediately.
Yes.
I thought that was really good. And we have Beth Broderick playing Bertha, who I know that a lot of you all will know Beth Broderick from most recently The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, but she was also in the original Sabrina the Teenage Witch, which is how I know her, as one of the aunties. But she just really gives a heartbreaking performance here, where she's being, you know, it seems so sincere when Candy says that she's sorry for her daughter's death, and she just kind of breaks and loses it and has to leave the room.
Yes. I mean, I wonder if we will see Bertha again, perhaps in the courtroom. But the casting has been very good, I think, mm-hmm. overall. If this is the only time that we see Bertha, that you go about to get someone who is so good. And I think the pulling power of David E. Kelly shows here that he can get sort of very established actors of reputation to come and just do one scene. It really matters. It really matters. Like the casting of Richard, the neighbor.
Yeah.
One episode and yet like really vital. Just even when Alan calls him first and says, will you go and check on Betty? The reluctance with which he agrees.
Yeah.
It's so minor, but it just gives a richness. What this Love and Death is really successful is giving us a milieu, giving us a world. And yes, it's a realistic world. It's 1980, it's Texas, but it's also what is the world of this show? What is the world of this production? And everybody and everything is integrated into that world. So, and the same here with Bertha. So I was very pleased to see her.
Yeah, me too. It's Father's Day also because things keep rolling along. And Pat loves his cards. He's one of those dads who actually like laughs at the Hallmark card with like all of his might.
Reads them out loud.
Uh-huh. Reads them out loud to everyone. That's a big thing with my family, or always has been, the reading the cards out loud.
Yes.
But also we typically leave personalized messages in our cards too. And we don't leave them empty. There's always like at least a gift card inside the card. Because no empty cards, my grandmother has always said.
A $2 note.
Exactly. Something, anything. So Candy drives the next day, or maybe later that day. She drives to the police station. First of all, she looks amazing.
He mentions it. She says, I don't know what you wear to a police station.
So yeah.
She errs on the side of dressed up.
Yes. And Candy kind of goes in, describes her day to them, including the Target story. And they ask her what kind of shoes she was wearing that day. And she lies and tells them she was wearing her tennis shoes. We all know she was in flip-flops that we later see her destroying. So we're at Betty's funeral. There was a little bit of hubbub at the wake about Pastor Ron, because he was the person that was going to be leading the funeral. And Betty hated him. Hated him. So.
With all the passive aggression of a Betty.
Yes, exactly. Pastor Ron does his, monosyllabic best.
I didn't like it. And then I did, because he said, people will say it's God's will. This is not God's will. I thought, whoa, Pastor Ron.
Yeah. What are you doing?
Wow.
Okay.
Wow. Yes.
So, yeah. Then Alan is interviewed by the police. And when asked the question about whether or not his wife had an affair, he tells the story, but says he did not have an affair. Which we all know because we've seen this show and know about this case. It's not the truth.
We saw the red velvet bread spread that please do not put a blue light onto.
Yeah, seriously. So later on, lying in bed, he cannot sleep, Alan. So he calls up the police chief, who I just realized is played by Buddy Garrity from Friday Night Lights. So this is a bit of a Friday Night Lights reunion for these two. And tells him that he, in fact, did have an affair. He had an affair with Candy Montgomery. And then we kind of pan over and we see Candy also unable to sleep in her bed and fade to black.
Very satisfying. For all the nits that we've picked along the way, I thought this was, for me, the best episode so far. It moved along. I mean, we've talked about like a lot of stuff happened. It moved along at a great clip, but it was able to pause for moments that we've mentioned, the squeezing of the orange juice and what that said about her internal life, the hugging, like various things like that. I was very pleased with this episode. How about you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was too. I actually quite enjoyed it. Like nits that we pick aside, I'm just questioning the writing more so than anything else, because I am really enjoying all of the performances. It's just, it's probably very difficult to convey exactly what a character like Candy Montgomery would be thinking, given all of the terrible things that she's done.
And she's kind of like what we know of the real Candy Montgomery, unknowable in a way.
Yeah, she's like the Sphinx.
It's weird. Absolutely. Speaking of writing, Latonya and I and many, many of our listeners, we love storytelling. That's why we watch, you know, all these shows and talk about them. Mm-hmm. And the storytelling is done by the writers. There's no acting without a script. There's no art direction without a script. There's no creation of a world without a script. And so we absolutely support the Writers Guild of America in the strike that they're currently having.
Yes, definitely stand with the writers and the showrunners of the Writers Guild of America. It has been interesting to hear of some of these big tentpole productions for HBO, for one, for Amazon, continuing to film without showrunners, and imagining that just because the scripts are done, that's the last thing that we would need. That's the last thing we would need the writers to do, when everyone knows that the writers are typically like on set to work through things with the actors to make revisions. So those scripts better be perfect, because there's no punching anything up because the writers are on strike right now, and very much deservedly so.
And know, if you're an actor on set with a written script and you punch that script up, you're a scab. Sorry, there's no other way around it. Right is right.
Sarah, sometimes I just can't believe the things that you say, but I love them.
Yes, oh. I'm union from way back.
Yeah. Love it. Love the WGA. We do hope that these massive streamers especially come to their senses and start paying people a fair wage. That's it about the writer's strike. Listen, we've got a Patreon. Speaking of paying people a fair wage. And we also have a store at Post Show Recap. So consider becoming a Post Show Recaps patron. Get early access to podcasts as well as Patreon exclusive podcasts. And any level, you get access to the Discord, which is a fantastic community where you can go and talk about, I don't know, shows like Love and Death, for example. Please come and talk to us about Love and Death. Not nearly enough people are doing that on the Discord, and I would really like someone to talk to about it. There is also merch that's available at higher levels of subscription. You can sign up at patreon.com/postshowrecaps or at postshowrecaps.com/patreon.
And some of you may not wish to join the Patreon, but you might want some merch. You can get that by heading to the store. That's postshowrecaps.com/store. You can buy everything Post Show Recaps, including t-shirts, mugs, monogrammed axes, refrigerators, blue eyeshadow, or a hat.
Mostly the hat, though.
Mostly the hat.
It's time for plugs. Plugs, 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 plugs. I don't know why I did that to Bone Thugs and Harmony, but
Thank you. We now have a plugs theme tune, and you'll be hearing that every week.
Great. I always seem to come up with songs on podcasts that come weekly. So there's ours. Sarah,
yes.
What do you have going on, and where can people find you?
People can follow me at Sarah Carradine on Twitter until I get my invitation to Blue Sky. Send it my way. I'm covering Queen Charlotte, A Bridgerton Story, episode by episode, with Sasha Joseph, Kirsten McInnes, and Geneva Guadalupe here on Post Show Recaps. That's all dropped The show has dropped, but we're doing two episodes a week if you want to catch up with us. And I co-host a weekly true crime review podcast called Crime Scene, S-E-E-N, on reality TV wrap-ups with the great Mari Forth. We have a great episode coming out with Katie and Kimberly from A Date with Dateline. That is one of the most hilarious ones we've done. It made me laugh when I was editing it. And, you know, it's a bit embarrassing to laugh at your own jokes, but we were very funny. What about you, Latanya? What have you got going on?
Aside from getting to hang out with you, lovely lady, I am working with Josh Wiggler on a little podcast called Versus. And let me tell you, Josh Wiggler and I are the best podcasters in all the world because we are doing Succession versus Yellow Jackets. Only Yellow Jackets did not have an episode come out this past week, and Succession did, but we still made a podcast happen.
That's
in
the
Versus arena. This is the way. That's another show that I love. But yeah, come and join us as we talk about the two buzziest water cooler shows that we could ever possibly think of. Sarah, I cannot wait for you to see this episode that you have waiting for you. And we'll talk all about all of the things that you're thinking about. Generational wealth versus generational trauma, people. It's got everything that you could possibly want. I am also talking about the final season of Barry with Mike Bloom.
So good.
Oh my gosh. So Barry is the first show that I've gotten screeners for. And it has been so difficult.
Ooh la la.
I know. I feel so like an actual journalist. Today, I just learned that we're going to get screeners for The Bear as well. And it just made me very, very happy. So it's very hard to keep secrets about what's going to happen. But I already know what's going to happen on Sunday's episode. And I think that you all will be delighted / surprised. So please tune
That's
in
my
for
favorite
us.
State of mind.
Great. Please tune in for us as we talk all about Barry. And finally, you can catch me over at Rehap. Talking about Top Chef, the international all-star season, which I am very excited to talk about with Haley Strong and Kurt Clark. We've also had some fun guests along the way. Podcast may be a little delayed this week because a couple people are traveling, but we will get it out to you. You can follow me on Twitter, where I'll talk about pretty much anything, honestly, at this point. At LK Starks, and then you can follow me on Instagram, where I am at Stormborn1222. Also, please do not forget to send us your comments, send us your questions. You can get to us on our Discord. You can email me in particular at latanya@postshowrecaps.com if you have any questions or comments about this show. But moreover, join us next week for episode 5. Until then, see y'all later.